Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program. I'm your host, David Katzmeyer, coming to you as I do every Thursday night, New York time at 8 o'clock, Pacific time at 5 p.m. Back by popular demand tonight, Ray Tomes of the Cycles Research Institute is here to tell us a little bit about how harmonics are replete throughout the universe. Cycles within cycles within cycles. There are harmonics not only in music, but in the motions of the galaxies and the motion in the things we see in our everyday life. We're beginning to learn a little bit more about the interconnectedness of the universe, the holographic aspect of the universe. What is here is elsewhere. I am that. As above, so below. Back in 1970, Bruno Mandelbrot, a mathematician, invented the word fractals. What a wonderful noun to give us a lexicon by which we can communicate with how we see patterns within patterns, in this case, with geometry. But there's also such things as fractal rhythms. We can realize that there's rhythms within rhythms. And once we understand these simple basics, we can understand a little bit more the complexities of harmonics throughout the universe, in events, in motion, in objects, and in all patterns. So with that in mind, we should consider that simplicity breeds complexity. We're going to talk a little bit about that tonight and tell you a little bit about the Cycles Research Institute, founded by Ray Tomes, which is a nice source for information on leading scholars, past and present, on such things as economics, cycles, rhythms of everything. So here, our special guest tonight is Ray Tomes. Ray, are you there?
Yes, David.
Thank you for joining us.
Nice introduction.
Okay, marvelous, marvelous. So, Ray, I've been reading your material at cyclesresearchinstitute.org, and I am endlessly fascinated. Tell me, Ray, is there an interconnectedness? Are there harmonics replete throughout the universe?
Oh, absolutely, David. That's been like what I want to talk about today is the story of how my research kept bringing more distant things together until I came across this idea of the harmonics theory.
Yep.
And in the final analysis, what that says is that there is only one stuff in the universe I call it wobbly universe. There's this one stuff and it wobbles. And everything that we see, everything that comes to us through our senses, everything that we know is the result of the wobbling of this stuff. And every part of it is connected to every part because every atom is, in fact, every atomic particle is, in fact, something that's wobbling. And the waves of that are going out and become the inwards waves for the other atoms and atomic particles in the universe. And this happens at all scales. It happens at the scale of galaxies, at the scale of stars and planets, and at the scale of atoms and subatomic particles.
Hmm. Oh, my goodness. So there is an interconnectedness of the universe. You know, pardon me for reflecting on Sanskrit here, but when you talk about all the different things are actually part of the one, it reminds me of Sanskrit where they say that polytheism and theism is actually the same thing. When they talk about the different gods of Vishnu, Shiva, Brahman, and so forth, they're saying that they're only looking at different aspects of the same oneness. And does this carry through in creation as we look at the manifestation, as we look at the creator being reflected in creation? Do we see that the complex, the many, are actually one?
Yes, well, that's one of the things. I didn't come across Eastern religions till later, but the idea from the Greeks, they had the different gods as well, and the god of war and the god of this and the god of that. And if we see these gods as forces, in scientific terminology, we can say there is a force for war. We know that Chizhevsky studied the cycles in war, and we can see that there's this rhythm going on, this breathing going on in the processes of war. And once we begin to understand that, we see that we can personify it or not personify it as we wish. That's a matter of personal taste. But the fact that there are these forces going on, these processes going on, there's no doubt about that.
Yes, and I'm fascinated. Joseph Campbell pointed out that there was only one story being told about religion. It's just being told in different times, cultures, and regions with different languages, but it's all the same myth when you look at the similarities between the Upanishads, the Book of Genesis, and so forth. So maybe when we look at the multitudes of harmonics, there's really only one rhythm that's reverberated in seemingly an infinite number of ways.
Yes. When you say that all the different religions, one of the things that I found funny when I came to the idea of the harmonics theory was to realize that that in science, the most basic thing in a lot of fundamental theories is called a wave equation. And we had Newton say, for every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And that is the thing that sets up oscillations. All oscillations and all cycles are based on that. But when we look at things like the Old Testament or the New Testament, one of them says in the beginning there was the Word, which is a sound oscillation. And the other one says, let there be light, which is also an oscillation. And I believe it's the same in all the religions, have something that says that that it can be taken to mean there was oscillation.
Fascinating. Well, Ray, tell me, how did you get involved in all this? I mean, when I was a boy, Ray, they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I told them a fireman.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, I wound up taking a different course. But
yeah.
I know that you're one of the leading researchers in the world on the study of cycles, so I don't want to make you blush, right? But what brought you into this in the first place?
Well, I was always interested in scientific stuff and mathematics. And I naturally got into computers. It was a new field at the time. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I was doing in computers was using mathematical models to try and do economic predictions for a customer, a financial services company. And in doing that, I wasn't looking for cycles. I was looking for ways to take a lot of data, which the general idea I had, I was making parallels to a physical system. I was seeing the economy and all the other aspects surrounding that as a person might look at a physical system, and I was looking at it that it's something that's been given a bang, and it's as a result it moves, and the change of one thing causes the change of something else, and so on, and that there'd be some way of working out that pattern. And I was using mathematical stuff called regression, and also factor analysis, which are just techniques for taking a lot of data from a lot of different variables and analyzing them together to try and work out what's going to happen next. And when I did this, I took some large number of economic variables in New Zealand, and I used the term economically fairly widely. I had demographics in there and trade, prices, all sorts of share markets, all sorts of things, birth and death rates, and everything, because I thought these things may be relevant. And when I put them all together and put them through a thing called factor analysis, which looks for common patterns, mm-hmm. what happened was all these cycles jumped out. I wasn't looking for them, but it seemed they were looking for me. Mm-hmm. And there was particular periods of cycles apparent in these factors that came out. And then I gave a talk at the Statistical Association in New Zealand, and the economist said, yes, this one that you've talked about there, that's the business cycle. That's all agreed that that exists. But they said, that long one you've got, that's the Kondratiev cycle, and that one's a juggler, and this is the such and such, but they don't exist. And I said, why do they have names if they don't exist? Oh, they've been discredited, they said. Well, I said, they're still there. And so I had to thank them for that, really, because I could then go and look these names up and find out, oh, yes, people have found a lot of these cycles before and begin to research it further.
Yeah.
The interesting thing was that one of the cycles that they said didn't exist, a bunch of people that were in social services all popped up and said, yes, that's the one that we see affects social services, you know, when there's more demand and less demand and so on and all that. And someone else said, yes, this one exists in this. And all the other people basically rubbished the economists. And I think that's very interesting, because later on, when we get to realizing that a lot of what I was discovering had previously already been discovered by Edward Dewey, and he, of course, was an economist, and he had to abandon the standard economics theories because they basically denied the existence of all these things. And people still look at the world this way, where they pretend that that stuff doesn't happen, this whole orchestra. And so I know in the Eastern ones, it's the dance of Shiva, isn't it?
It's amazing.
That's what's going on. There are all these things that are moving together, and that's the thing that really comes out. You can find one thing, one cycle, say 4.5 years, and that's present in many different things, some of which seemingly related and some are not so seemingly related. So what happened then is, having been given this look at the cycles, I decided I'd better start actually looking for them. So I devised my own method to go through and look for how to find cycles and lots of data. And I found, at that stage, I found four cycles, which were quite strong, and they were 4.45 years, 5.9 years, 7.15 years, and about 8.9 years. Now, it was a while later that before I realized, and when I used those, they worked. I could make predictions that were much better than the economists made in those times. So, for example, and there was a much longer cycle as well, this Kondratiev period sort of one.
Which for is example, around 50 years or 40-some, 50-some
yeah,
years?
Yeah, 53, 54 years is an accepted period. Now, I didn't have enough data to be able to get the period very accurately because I only had 44 years of data, and so I had almost one full cycle. So I couldn't say exactly what the period was, but I knew it was a long one. And what happened is that that cycle showed up very much in relation to inflation in New Zealand. And so I was able to say at that time, when the Prime Minister, on the advice of economists, was telling us that inflation that had just rocketed up to 15% and interest rates that had just gone up to 15%, were all going to go back over the next 3 years back down to nice tidy figures around to about 3 to 5% again. And I was able to say, no, they're not. They're going to stay up at least at 15% for another 5 years. And they did that. So that it was possible to make those sort of predictions. So I devised methods to look for cycles and the things and determine those periods accurately. And then later on, I realized those four periods that I found were fractions of 35.6 years. One was a quarter, one was a fifth, one was a sixth, and one was an eighth.
Oh.
And it was clear that that if you could find these things in the economy and if there were lots of cycles. And when I looked, I found there was one that was a third of that period and one that were other fractions, a tenth and a twelfth and so on as well. So I began to look wider and I thought, I could make money with this. So I got hold of I got hold of 40-something years of weekly corn prices. And when I analysed those, there were a whole bunch of different cycles present. And then I realised that the ones that I'd found in that were the behaviour of it was exactly if someone had sat on a piano keyboard and hit two octaves of white notes with a couple of black notes at each octave as well. Not every note had sounded properly, but most of them had. And that musical relationship was there.
Yep.
Was then made me realise this 4-5-6-8 that I'd found originally. That's a major chord. That those are the exact proportions of the frequencies in a major chord. So the New Zealand economy was playing a major chord, and the corn prices were doing the whole scale all at once.
That's music to my ears, Ray. And you didn't go in with prejudice looking for this.
I wasn't.
It's after you
that.
Found it, you realised its relationship.
I wasn't looking for it. No. And at that stage, when I first did this, was in 1977. I began doing this work, and it was some years later when I'd done quite a lot of work on it. I happened to go to a talk by George Lane, and he mentioned that there was this place called the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. And so I determined, and that was 1989, I went for my first trip to see the foundation. And at that time, I came across Edward Dewey's article about that he started from 35.5 years and he divided it by 2 and 3 and multiplied by 2 and 3, and this produced many common cycles. So he had 8.88 years and 4.44 years, which were when he divided by 2, which were very close to my 4.45 years. And when he divided by 3, he got 5.92 years. So he was getting the same cycles periods with this method of division by 2 and 3. And of course, out of 4, 5, 6, and 8, 4, 6, and 8 are all proportions of 2s and 3s. And he did have the other cycle there, which was the fifth of it as well, but it didn't fit in his little table of proportions. And those 2 and 3 proportions are generally taken to be the musical proportions, as mentioned by Pythagoras. But the 5 proportion does occur. It didn't occur according to Pythagoras, but the father of Galileo, the famous one, he showed that in music that proportion does occur, that when you have a major chord of C, C, E, G, C, So E is not 81 over 64 times C, it's actually 5 over 4, so the 5 proportion does occur in there. And that ties together a couple of loose ends that Dewey hadn't picked up. But he didn't know where to stop his table. He saw that at some points it started to fade out, but he didn't really know where to stop it. And so it was some time later that I worked out how exactly to do that, but it was quite clear that he was using different data in different countries in a different time period and finding exactly the same common cycles as what I was finding later on in New Zealand.
Good.
And when I got data on, for example, the world economy, I found that the world money supply and the world capital formation were exactly the same graphs as two of the ones I got from just the New Zealand economy. So it was very clear that what was happening in the New Zealand economy was not caused by conditions in New Zealand. It was imported from overseas. It was a global phenomenon. And the more we look at this stuff and the deeper we go into this, and I know that all the people in the past that have gone into this, such as Dewey and others, many others, have come to the same conclusion, Chijewski, that these things don't begin on Earth. They begin outside the Earth because we can find the same period cycles in the motions of the planets and, in fact, even in distant galaxies. We can observe some of the cycles present. So then that became a fascinating thing that I'd worked on. And initially I was working on it for that. You can make better investments if you buy at the lows in the stock market. If you know about what the period is, you can time those about right. And the same when you buy or sell property or other things, which people naturally do occasionally in their life. If you use this information, you can make much better decisions there that will improve your wealth. But after some years of doing that in my business, the whole scientific question of where did all of this come from, how did it all work for the whole universe, it became clear it was a bigger and bigger problem. And I was studying it many hours a day. At that point, I made a decision to retire and to study this full time. At that time, I was 42. For those that are Douglas Adams fans, they'll know that the question's about 42 in Douglas Adams. Well, for me, the question was
the meaning of life.
That the meaning of life is to retire and try and work out how the universe works. So that got me going, and I then began to study cycles and everything and collect data on everything, and I could see this pattern getting wider and wider. And when I saw that there were these lots of proportions of 2 and 3, which I had also found before I knew about Dewey, it was clear that, and the fact that there were cycles that were harmonics of each other and the musical relationships, I realized that this about that time in the late 70s, nonlinear systems were making an appearance in the popular scientific media. So you had the Mandelbrot set and those things, which were really fascinating things, and other different processes people were inventing that made chaos theory and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I began to look at nonlinear systems. And it was clear immediately that if you had a nonlinear system and you had a cycle in one thing, then whatever else it affected nonlinearly would not only have the original cycle, but would have harmonics of it. To give you an example, supposing that there's an 11-year cycle in the weather. The sunspot cycle is 11 years, and the sun does get warmer and cooler, so we can expect there to be some effects in the weather on Earth.
Yeah.
Now, let's supposing that we are growing wheat in a region which, on average, has the right conditions for the maximum amount of wheat. But because the weather is changing, whether it be getting too wet and too dry or too hot and too cold, at some point it's correct. And over an 11-year cycle, it now goes too much, the right amount, too little, the right amount. Mm-hmm. Too much, the right amount, too little, the right amount. So in one 11-year cycle, we come back to the right amount twice. And that means that the 11-year cycle of the sun has now converted to a 5.5-year cycle in wheat.
Ah.
Later on, when I began to research this, I discovered, do you know who the first person who discovered that was?
No, who was it?
Sir William Herschel. The first man to discover a planet since ancient times.
Yes.
And so in the 1700s, he prepared a paper about this and showed how there was a linkage between the sunspot cycle and the price of wheat. Now, he used wheat because he was trying to actually show that it would affect climate, but they didn't have good enough climate records in those times. So he said the substitute for climate is the yield of crops, because the rainfall and the temperatures affect the crop yield. So, but he said there wasn't good enough information on the yields, but there was good information on the price, and he said the price will be higher when the yield is lower, so he used that. So he actually had this picture of this whole process from the sun affecting things, and he gave a talk at the Royal Society, and he was rubbished. People got up and said, that's a load of nonsense. Cycles researchers have learned to face this for countless generations since then. But the thing is, just a few years ago, someone went back and collected the data that he had available, because the actual stuff was lost. And when they analyzed it, they found that it was very highly significant. He was absolutely correct, the data about. But I was puzzled, because I saw no mention. He mentioned in 11 that the sunspot cycle showed up in the wheat. Now, if we look at the wheat prices in the United States, we find this is a 5.5-year cycle. It's a very clear cycle. It's 5.54 years, exactly half the sunspot cycle period. But in England, it's actually 11 years. Why should that be so? And the answer is, in England, it's too cold to grow wheat. That means that it never gets too hot and then right and too cold. It ranges between a little bit too cold and a lot too cold. And that means you don't get this doubling of the frequency.
Right.
The halving of the period. Whereas in America, you get conditions that vary either side of the correct conditions. So you get this doubling of the frequency, the halving of the period of the sunspot cycle. Now, what I showed was, mathematically, it's a very simple thing to show that no matter what the shape of their graph there is, where one thing causes something else, say rainfall or temperature affects the yield of a crop, but no matter what the shape of the graph is, you can draw any shape graph you like, the result is always the same. You get the original, if you put one cycle in, what you get out is that cycle plus the sum of various amounts of the different harmonics. The one cycle that's half as long, a third as long, a quarter as long, and a fifth as long, and so on. And this began to tie in with what I had found in those original cycles. That were proportions of 35.6 years. So I began to look, what's the longest cycle? But I found there were mentions of longer cycles, 71 year and longer cycles, right up to 2,300 and 4,600 year cycles that were mentioned in the climate. And when I kept doubling those figures, it quite seemed like it was just doing doubling all the time. And there was this musical pattern off it. And I originally got slightly the wrong maths on the thing, and I corrected that around 1989, to get the correct maths of the formula for how to generate the harmonics to get exactly the sort of thing that was actually observed in many areas of the economy and of scientific areas.
Is this posted anywhere on your sites, Ray?
This is the main thing. So if you look on my site, ray.tomes.biz, and if you look under the...
for listeners, Tomes is spelled like Holmes with a T, T-O-M-E-S, ray.tomes.biz. Thank you, Ray. Please continue.
Yeah, well done, David. And if you look under, and you've got it in the announcement of this program, you've got two links there, one to the site and one to an article, math.html.
Yeah, look at the narrative, either on colorhythms.org or blogtalkradio.com/cycles, where the write-up for this show is. There's clickable links over there.
Yes. And so that's the maths one explains all of this in much more detail than I'll be doing here. So where were we?
So write-ups on these principles that you found, you refined this in 1989 to make it even more accurate, and you found a formula that had applicability to universal harmonics.
Here's the one axiom that you'll find on that page, which I came to, and it basically says this. It says the universe is made up of a standing wave. A standing wave is just something that oscillates in place. We can think of it as like a plucked guitar string, except that's only a one-dimensional thing. The universe is three-dimensional, or we could think of it like a bowl of jelly that you wobbled, or like a big blob of metal that you whacked with a hammer. It's a piece of stuff that's got oscillation going on in it, and the initial oscillation is determined by the speed of sound in the medium In the case that you whack a big piece of metal, it will vibrate in a frequency which the standing wave, the time for the wave to go backs and forwards across the thing once, will be the frequency. Now, that's the initial frequency, but what the axiom says is that the initial standing wave, because of the nonlinearity of the laws of physics, will produce harmonics of itself. Now, this is nothing new in this so far. All of this so far is well-known science, well-known physics, that any physics person can tell you that's correct. But then I went one step further. I said, and each of those is itself a standing wave, and therefore will do the same. Now, that's the part that I explored that, as far as I know, no one had ever done before. And so when you begin to do that, you say, let's supposing that we have a frequency in this big blob of stuff that we hit with a hammer. Let's call it frequency 1. Then it will make harmonics. So there are frequencies 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those, though, is now the seed for a new set of harmonics because it's a standing wave in its own right. Now, I should mention, this does not happen in one-dimensional instruments such as a guitar or a violin. You do get that set of harmonics, but the harmonics themselves do not make new ones. But when you go to two- or three-dimensional things, this process does begin to happen, but it's a very gradual process, so you have to have a system that doesn't have loss of energy. The universe is very good at that. There's nowhere for it to go. So it keeps on going, and gradually over time, the harmonics of the harmonics begin to evolve, and the harmonics of the harmonics of the harmonics. So what we get is frequency 2 begins to make frequencies that are multiples of itself, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, etc. And frequency 3, multiples of itself, 6, 9, 12, 15. And frequency 4 makes 8, 12, 16. Frequency 5 makes 10, 15. Frequency 6 makes 12, and so on. Now, if you were listening there, you probably heard me say 12 quite a few times.
Uh-huh.
So notice that the harmonic that is 12 times the frequency of the original was receiving energy via many different paths, and in actual fact, there are 8 paths that lead to that, whereas the frequencies 11 and 13, there's only one path each. So the frequency 12, we can expect to be 8 times stronger than those other two. And when we begin to calculate this out to larger numbers, for example, we find that the particularly strong harmonics are 48, 60, 72, and 96. Mm-hmm. Those ones are exactly in the proportion 4, 5, 6, 8, the ones that are originally found in the economy.
And they are thinner divisions as such, and in, you know, the notes in a musical scale, there's 12.
So we produce the major chord. When we look at next strongest ones in between those, we find that they in fact give all the white notes plus 2 of the black notes in the musical scale.
Right.
Exactly the thing I had found in the corn prices.
Oh, my.
So now we see this process of harmonics can produce exactly the sort of structure that is music, and exactly the sort of thing that's observed and been reported by. Now, I had got that far before I first visited the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. So when I read Dewey's thing with all these pattern of cycles in, he said he couldn't explain why it happened, it just did. And I now knew why it did. I also found articles. I found an article by someone who said that they'd found the musical scale in the stock market prices, so they had the whole musical scale there. So these things were there, and people have done analysis. When we look at people like Hurst and so on, they were onto the same thing. And a number of others, we can find mentions of harmonics in the likes of Gann and so on, although I find his stuff very difficult to follow. He was trying to point people in that direction, though.
Well, this is fascinating. So if somebody says, can you tell me about the cycles of the sun? Sure, let me just check the recent wheat prices.
Yeah.
So it's manifestation. Understanding the abstract plus the physical causality and the manifest, but that's where the art and the science come together.
Yeah. Now, if we draw a graph of the wheat prices and a graph of the sunspots, they don't look exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Because for a start, in most places, we're getting the second harmonic of it. But not only that, it's only the ones that are tuned correctly or that have resonance. So, for example, let's supposing we have a room where there's a whole orchestra playing and we've got the old wine glass sitting there. Only when the soprano sings the right note that's the frequency of the wine glass does the wine glass begin to vibrate.
Yes.
And if she gets it just right, she can shatter it, and it really can be done. Now, the reason for that is resonance requires that you be on the frequency that something else naturally vibrates. So if there's corn, if people are growing wheat, then it's partly caused by the conditions, but it's partly caused by the feedback in the system. So if people grow wheat and there's a lousy price 1 year, they'll probably grow a little less the next year. Price might pick up a little bit, and so they still don't bother. And a couple of years later, it's really picked up high because they're not growing enough, and the yields have been getting better as well, or whatever, at the same time. And so they now reverse their position, and they start growing a lot, and of course you get back to a glut. So in all economic systems, the reaction time of people to what's been happening, because people are always looking at the immediate past to work out their
position.
That's right. Which is exactly wrong, because that's not how it works. It happens in cycles. But the reason it happens in cycles is because people do that. And so we won't find every aspect of sunspots reflected in the prices of wheat.
Right.
But the ones that have the right frequency to affect something else on Earth that then affect wheat and has a natural resonance will show up. And this is why everything has different cycles in it, but from the same set. We find the same cycles occurring in many different things. Those four I mentioned originally occur in many different things. They are four of the very common ones, and there are some other common ones that Dewey mentions. For example, 9.6 years, and then there's the 40-month cycle and fractions of that. Now, one of the fractions of the 40-month cycle does occur in the wheat prices also. So we can, and it's very, very accurately the case. Dewey said that the cycle in the stock market was 40.68 months. When I found one of the prices, one of the cycles in wheat, it was very accurately fitted with that, as being half of that or a quarter of that, and a number of other being half of that. And there were a number of other cycles which were found later on by scientists studying the sun, found a whole series of harmonically related cycles that fit back to that stock market cycle and that wheat cycle. So, but Dewey never connected those, the 9.6 year cycle or the 40 month cycle, he never connected those into his other matrix. But with this method that I had now worked out of the harmonics of harmonics, I then said, okay, I can calculate by hand up to 100. So I wrote a little computer program to calculate up to 1,000,000. And sure enough, this cyclical pattern kept on happening. But some other interesting thing happens. You got proportions of 2 and 3, but after a while, you got a proportion of 5 that became very clear. And I gave a name to something. I called it the mainline harmonics. Initially, the strongest harmonics from the frequency 1 are 2 and 4. But although 8 and 16 are strong cycles, it was 12 that was the really next strong one. We got a proportion of 3 in there, and then 24 and 48. And then we somewhere in there we have to have a proportion of 5, and we get another strong cycle occurring at 28, at 1440 and 2880, and then we get another big peak at 34,560. Now that particular number, I might claim that number as my number, because that one is a key to understanding all that happens after that. That number is 2^8 times 3 cubed times 5, and it's the first. It's a really, really strong harmonic. So 12 was a strong one, and again at 144, 288, 2880, and this is a really big one. And then they start to get a little lesser. So we've got waves upon waves here. This is the super wave, and there's another wave that's about every 12 ratio. But at powers of this number, there were other very strong harmonics as well. So now I had to write some cleverer computer programs rather than just calculate every harmonic up to 1,000,000. I had to find ways to calculate the stronger harmonics up to larger numbers. So the first time I went up to 10 to the 20th, and every time a new computer came out and I got a faster processor, I whack it up to 10 to the 30th or 40th, and last time about 10 to the 50th. It's probably possible to go up to 10 to the 60th now. And when that is done, a fascinating thing is observed that at near ratios of that 34,560, not exactly that ratio, but at near powers of that number, there are especially strong harmonics. Now, when it became clear to me that was the case, I said, okay, what if the universe, as the Big Bang theory said it was, what if that size, if we keep dividing that size by this, because the thing divides up both time and space.
Yes.
It's the harmonics. When we pluck the guitar string, the harmonic is half the wavelength and twice the frequency, or three times and four times the wavelength, and that fraction, that times the frequency and that fraction of the wavelength. So when we do that with the universe, if we keep looking at this powers of something around about 34,560, the first time we divide it, we find it gives us a reasonably good estimate of how far apart galaxies are. In other words, the first really strong harmonic is responsible for the formation of galaxies. The next division of that gives us the typical distance between stars. The typical distance between the planets. In fact, it's the outer planets it gives us rather than the inner ones. And then the next one, the typical distance between moons. There's a lot of variations in these things. But
so, Ray, let me ask you a question. Is it, could we possibly find sort of a three-dimensional model of a Mandelbrot set, not the Mandelbrot set, but say, but using that as an example, a Mandelbrot set in 3D that might explain the positioning and the relationship of the galaxies and the stars?
Yeah, well, potentially.
Self-iterating process, a simple code that could explain the complexity of the layout.
There are published reports about the galaxies having particular redshift multiples, and they show that the distances of galaxies and also their galactic clusters, there are walls of galactic clusters at certain intervals. And that we'll come back to that when I get onto the geological cycles. We'll find that the distances of those, they are, the distance of those is the wavelength that goes with the period of the long geological cycle. It all links together. It's very clear that it's all one process. So, yes, these things, every way that you can think of linking it, you can find the links. They're there. And then the next one after moons, there's no obvious thing. The next distance scale turns out to be about a mile, and the one after that a couple of inches. And the one after that is the typical spacing of cells. And the one after that is the spacing of atoms in a crystal or something. And the one after that is the distance between the protons and neutrons in the nucleus of an atom. So we find that repeated over this thing, every scale at which there is some strong energetic structure that can arrange itself so that things are regularly spaced, turns out to fit this pattern that of around about that number 34,560.
That is universal. Folks, I just want to mention you listen to the Cycles of Change radio program. If anybody would like to call in and ask Ray a question, you can call in at area code 347-884-9593. That's area code 347-884-9593. So the macrocosm is the microcosm, and you're getting corroborations for the things that you found when you weren't looking for them, and then found that other people had discovered them too. So you've had almost redundant corroboration of the things that you find replete in all things in motion and matter and whatnot, geometry and everything else, great and small. So they're real, baby.
And I mentioned that you got these stronger cycles around 12, around 144, again at 2880 and 34560. And often these peaks, so if we call that the sort of super wave, the one that's the 34,560, or the, around about that order of magnitude repeating, then the secondary ones are often at a ratio 12 to that. And so, for example, when we look at the galaxies, we will find the distance to something like the Andromeda Nebula is... There's also a second distance that's 1/12 that as much, which is the distance to the Magellanic Clouds, the two little hanger-on galaxies to our galaxy. And when we look at Andromeda, we see it's got two little hanger-on galaxies, two little hanger-on ones as well. Someone said to me once when I was describing that these things were like the bonds in an atomic structure, someone said to me, yes, I'd often thought that both Andromeda and us are H2O molecules. And I went, yeah, they're right. A big one with two little ones.
Yeah.
So when you start to see that, and the distance between those are very accurately a 12th, as far as we know, the distance to Andromeda of that. When we look at the solar system, we find that the outer planets, there's a very clear arithmetic progression. Now, Bode's law is always given as a geometric progression, and there's some element of that there. But in actual fact, it turned out wrong when it got to Neptune and Pluto.
Yeah.
If we look at the...
Neptune and Uranus, they kind of change positions, which one is closer to the sun, because they've been nudging each other. And also, when you look at the asteroid belt, that helps corroborate Bode's law a little bit. But
yeah,
it's sort of a loose rule, Bode's law.
It is, yeah. But it does fit partly, but there's a couple of things slightly wrong. And when we look at them as a series of arithmetic series, if we look at Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, their distance in astronomical units are very near 10, 20, 30, 40.
Hmm.
When we put Jupiter in there, it's at 5. And when we look at some of the other objects that are found, there's a tendency for them to be at places like 35 and 45. There's a whole bunch of stuff out past Pluto at 45 astronomical units. So we can see that there's a strong 10 astronomical unit wave going through and a 5 astronomical unit. But the inner planets, they fit a much smaller wave, about 0.35 astronomical units. So Mercury, Venus, and Earth are at 1, 2, 3. And Mars is nearer to 5 than 4, but it's a little bit of a misfit. And when we look at the best fit, again, not taking any prejudicial mind, but using a method designed by a Russian researcher called Kotov, we can fit this data and find out what values tend to fit where all these things are multiples or fractions of it. And it tells us that 5 astronomical units and 10 astronomical units are very important, and 0.35 and 0.7 are. And when we divide those sets into each other, we find there's a ratio 7 in there, or a 14 between those sets. Now, that's a fascinating thing because it leads to a whole bunch of other stuff that is totally unexpected.
Well, I want to get to that in a minute, Ray, but before we do, I do want to squeeze in a caller here.
Okay.
You may want to pick up on what you said, but just one quick, I'm coming to you in a minute, but I want to comment about the planets. Planets have to find their settling point after you have, you know, dust and meteors accrete into a planet. Then there may be these abstract laws that say that you're going to be so much of a distance and reach a harmonic, but they have to find their point to get nudged by moons and nudge each other. It's just like the flywheel effect in economics. You say you have an 11 point whatever year cycle in the sun, but we're reacting to it with our crop prices, our response to yields, our response to market demands and everything like that. So there's a human element. But in it all, between the abstract reality and the actual manifestation of it, whether we're seeing human endeavors or the motions of planets, they are being influenced as they change and adapt by abstract principles that are there. Caller, area code 262, welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Are you there?
I am here.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, hi, Ray. Pleasure to speak with you. Hoping someday you're going to get a Nobel for your work. It's terrific stuff.
Oh, my.
Thank you. My questions are, I'm wondering if you come, the numbers, pi or phi, the golden mean, show up in your harmonic work at all?
The simple
and
answer
then my
is no.
Second...
It was a great question.
Go ahead, please.
No, carry on there.
He says no.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear that part. I was talking over him. All right, so thanks for that. And the second part then, I guess I've got a question on, I'm looking at, your relative strength of harmonics chart, and 1 through 100. And I notice all of the weak ones are prime numbers. So I'm guessing, but wondering if that goes on when you run into the millions of cycles, and if you could speak to how prime numbers fit into your theory, if you could, please.
And Ray, before you answer that, I want folks to know you can go to ray.tomes, T-O-M-E-S, T as in Thomas, ray.tomes.biz/maths, M-A-T-H-S, dot. HTML. Sorry, Ray. I just want folks to be able to follow along. There's a lot of great formulas there that you can look at while we're talking. Ray, please continue.
Yeah. Okay. Just to expand slightly the first question, Pi does show up a tinsy bit in certain ways, but not really in the harmonic structure, but it is relevant. Phi, or phi, someone pronouncing it, it doesn't show up at all. It's quite a different thing. It is a thing in nature that's relevant, but it's not connected with harmonic theory. So now coming back to your second question, what was the second question again?
Second question was about the prime numbers. I noticed in your
prime numbers, yes.
The all the weak ones are prime numbers.
Absolutely. Yes, that's correct. So in the harmonics theory, the strong harmonics are the ones that have many ways of being factorized. Now, people sometimes take that to be many factors. That's not correct. The correct statement is many ways of being factorized. And, of course, primes are the ones that have only one way of being factorized. So they all primes are naturally the very weakest harmonics in the harmonics theory. Now, you'll notice that 2, 3, and 5 still occur in the thing early in the piece, but at that stage, almost every number is a prime number, so they still show up. But as we get further up, prime numbers become more and more the weakest ones. And the numbers that are the strong harmonics, generally, especially if you get a long way up, will have many powers of 2, a lesser number of powers of 3 in them, and less still of 5 and 7 and so on in them. But they do have many ways of being factorized. That's the key thing. So that's an important observation. And there is available on my website a CSV file which has got all the harmonics calculated there, how strong they are, the number of ways they can be factorized, and you can look at those and see what is the factorizations of them and see the patterns, and you can plot those graphs of the like that first 100 or the first million and so on. You can plot those out to very large numbers and see what the patterns look like for yourself if you want, and you can mess around with those numbers. Actually, something that David said the other day, I realized that I haven't done everything I should have done with that. I did some additional work which is not on there, and that is, if you put the longest cycle of the universe, now I need to explain something else before I do that, but if you put the longest cycle of the universe in there, you can use those harmonics to calculate the actual cycle periods of all cycles. Now, how did I arrive at the longest cycle of the universe? The answer was, the pattern that was being predicted and the pattern that's observed in cycles are very similar. But because there's many proportions of 2 and 3, you can fit it. If you slide the whole thing by multiplying everything by 2, it looks very similar. So I had to find a way of matching them up to find out which is the actual real match to the universe. So to do that, on a log scale, I put all the harmonics that are predicted, and I put all the cycles periods that are commonly found. And I used ones from up as far as about 600 million years down to about a month, which there was good data on. So the long ones are geological cycles. And when that's done, I then slide these two things past each other to see where they match. Now, I do this on the computer mathematically, and I produce a graph showing how good does it fit. And you'll see that graph on that maths page. And it shows that there's one particular number, about 1.4 times 10 to the 23 years, which is an especially good fit. And you'll see a little pattern, a symmetrical pattern about that, which is to be expected. That it's exactly double or exactly half that, it still gives a similar result. Now, that number is very important, that period. What that is saying is, this is the number one cycle of the universe. It happens to be 10 million million times longer than the age of the universe according to the Big Bang people. So at that point, I have to say that the Big Bang theory has to be wrong, that the universe is vastly more ancient than the Big Bang people think. What they're seeing is only one of the important cycles along the way. In that sort of range, that there are bigger cycles going on beyond that of bigger and more important things. So when that's done, and the calculation's done, it gives this very good fit to all these cycles that are known. And just to mention, before that, I had a hint of that happening, because when I made a trip to Russia in the 1990s, the professor of geology at Moscow University, Professor Afanasyev, gave me his book on, which is called Nanocycles Method, where he had a method of calculating geological cycles. And he had calculated that there's one cycle of 586.24 million years, Now, I knew about the existence of this cycle from Western things. There's a guy, Williams, in Australia, and he was organized a conference, or he was an important person at a conference on geological cycles. And he mentions a series of cycles, each of which is half the previous one. And he gives a figure, which implies it's, he says 600 million years, but the shorter cycles he gives implies it would be a little less than that. When I had that period of 586.24 million years, when I do the proportions, just twos and threes and fives, and there's 111 and 113 come in there, I end up getting one of the periods in the common cycles range, 11.8622 years. That's Jupiter's period around the sun. It gives that to six-digit accuracy. These things don't happen unless something real is going on. In every cycle that's known, when you determine the most accurate known value for the cycle, it fits the pattern when that's like the master key one I use. So that's how I can get the cycle of the universe very, very accurately going backwards from that one.
Wow. That is pretty amazing. Right? And I agree with you, by the way, that the universe is not expanding. That's all based on the redshift that Edwin Hubble observed in 1929. The further the galaxy or the star away it is, the redder it is. Therefore, it must be a Doppler effect in light. But then there's also other theories, you know, such as tired light theory, that by the time the light gets to us, it gets worn out and the waves become longer and longer, and the longer waves are red, the shorter ones are blue.
That's an interesting area, David. When one of the things that from that is that I realize that if you've got this process of making harmonics, it's making energy go to smaller and smaller scales. So when we consider the wave that is a proton or a neutron, it is gradually producing harmonics within that, which would be quarks. Now, the result of that, it turns out that the movement of energy to smaller scales means that those ones become stronger. The frequencies of those becomes ever so slightly faster because there's more mass and more energy in there now. And quantum mechanics says when there's more energy, it will vibrate faster. And when we do that and work backwards, we say, well, that to get the red shift that we observe there is, if we use that data to go backwards, when we do that, we find that the rate of absorption also explains the strength of gravity. So gravity, in fact, is the process of conversion of energy to smaller scales. And so all of these things, the atomic particle frequencies that are measured, they're called Compton frequencies, and the spacing of them in the nucleus agree with each other. And just as I mentioned, this long cycle, this long geological cycle, the data on these big walls of galactic clusters in space also fits. The latest estimate of the Hubble constant gives that as 588 million light years. Now, I say that it must be really the 586.24 million light years to go with that cycle in the geological cycles. So it shows that the universe, whole universe, is still oscillating at those frequencies, as well as having produced all these faster frequencies, and that oscillation is the cause of massive geological cycles. When we start dividing that by twos, there reaches a point where we have to divide by 11, and it gives a 26.65 million year period. That period agrees very, very accurately with the best estimates of the mass extinctions of life on Earth.
Yes.
So that's a very important one. When that's divided by 12, it gives 2.22 million years, and that is in light years is the distance quantum of some of the nearby galaxies. When we halve it again, 1.11 million years, that period is present in the solar system as the longest known period to me. In the solar system, it's an energy exchange between Jupiter and Neptune where the dynamics of the solar system gradually oscillate. So all these long cycles fit into each other all the way down. So we can go right down to the atomic particles. They are just oscillations. When we realize that this process predicts the scale at which the atomic particles will vibrate, then we have to realize what's going on. This is just wobbly stuff of the universe. They aren't particles. They are waves. So I began to, I put an article on internet in the 1990s when internet had only been going not that long when I joined, and I put an article saying that I believed that atomic particles were standing waves in this way, fitting in with what I'd said. And I got a reply from a guy named Milo Wolf, and he said, "Welcome to the club." He said, "I've been trying to say that for years." And he's a physicist, and he's written two excellent books, and it's called The Wave Structure of Matter. If you look on the Cycles Research Institute site, you'll find a lot of stuff about wave structure of matter. And I think it's very important that if people understand that matter is just waves, there's no particle nature at all. The only thing that's particle about it is the waves are spherical standing waves. They're coming into a point, so you get a concentration of energy, but it's pure wave energy. Totally.
And we're mostly space, and we're finding out that the majority of the universe may, in fact, be invisible if you believe in the theories of dark energy and dark matter. You mentioned your site, cyclesresearchinstitute.org, where you can find great research material. You can actually get free software to analyze cycles yourself, and it's been made easy to use by Ray, who is bilingual. He talks tech and he talks human. And so we get this great window into the genius minds of the world of how we are finding that we can move out of linear thought and get away from Newtonian, Cartesian archetypes and models of our thinking to realize that we're really speeding our knowledge up as humankind. We're moving so far that we're actually beginning to catch up with the past and find out that a lot of the ancients, allegorical though they may have been in the writings, were in fact seeing something that's real. We're just recognizing it now. It takes one to know one, and we're beginning to see the wisdom in their writings. Ray, some of the things that you mentioned are indeed universal truth. Call it from area code 262. Would you like to tell us your name, just so we know? You had some great questions.
Oh, my name is Mark Olson. So just terrific work that you're doing, Ray. I mean, my follow-up question was going to be on if you've given thought to dark energy and dark matter, and if your harmonic theory is going to help, you know, define what those might be.
We're in our final 3 minutes, Ray, so I'm going to give it a go.
Yeah, recently not, but going back in the 1990s, when I was debating with physicists about stuff on the internet, some of them said, well, how does this work in terms of how much energy is in what? And I had a go. Now, it depends on making one assumption about the harmonic theory works regardless of the rate at which the energy drops off as you go to higher powers, higher harmonics. And I assumed it was inverse square law, which if I assume that, then I did a calculation and it showed how much missing mass, because at that stage there was a missing mass problem in the larger scales in the universe. And I did get a graph, and it did come out to explain the missing mass as it was known then. Now, I haven't tried to update that, and that's almost 20 years ago now, and a lot more accurate measurements have been made. But I would say the energy is in those large waves. Those large waves are very energetic waves. So you've just got a whole set of – I see them as more or less electromagnetic waves, or if the preferred case, I understand them as the vibrations of the ether. So if we just imagine this whole universe full of ether, which is a tensile medium and wobbling, then a big proportion of the energy is in those very largest waves. They're the ones that everything else flows from. And the string theory people are coming from the wrong end. They're right that it's vibrations, but they're trying to start at the small and produce the big. My results show very, very clearly that that it works from the large down, from the top down, not from the bottom up.
Fascinating. Ray, you know, we're going to have to invite you back on this program, and I may be extending an invitation to you to consider a two-hour program where we take in some call-in questions like these great ones. Mark, I thank you so much for that. We're going to be following up on some of these questions about
the
universe and astronomy next week with Dr. Paul Halpern, who authored The Edge of the Universe and another book called The Cyclical Serpent. He gets into the cycles as well. He's broken out of the old paradigm of thinking. I heard him speak about a week ago, invited him to be on the show. He'll be with us. But Ray, fascinating stuff that you have here. Ray Tomes from the Cycles Research Institute. Visit him at cyclesresearchinstitute.org. Also at ray.tomes.biz. Find out a little bit more about what he's saying. Like I say, folks, this is one of the leading researchers in the world on cycles, but he explains it to us in a way that we can all understand because these are universal truths. You are listening to the Cycles of Change radio program here at blogtalkradio.com/cycles. We invite you to come back next Thursday at 8 o'clock. where we're going to follow up on these discussions. And Ray, we are so extending an invitation for you to come back for another special program as you did this time.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Ray. And good night from the Cycles of Change. Ray, great job. Wow.
I was just in the middle of typing great to you. Now.
Ray, if you're up for it, I would love to see us do a two-hour program. I mean, an hour with you is like 15 minutes. Oh, my God. And,
there.
You know, I have to say, oh, well, we're at the end of the hour, and it's like we're in the middle of a thought. I mean,
yeah.
And people are just love what you have to say, and your story about how you got into this is, you know, you've got your own MetaMac conference experience in your life. So,
yeah.
Oh, my God. We really – I hope you consider it, Ray. I would like to do a special
two-hour
program.
Yeah, I'd be
program.
Very happy to, David.
Oh,
yeah.
You – bless
about,
you.
Talking about MetaMac conference,
yep.
I managed to get the paper on that.